I saw that thing Graham was doing before about the guy with the big bushy white beard, and I was sure this was going to be about me, showering gifts on people, wearing cool hats. I think I added to some of the stuff Graham mentioned, but anyway. Well, thanks for coming, because like half of our church is either overseas or has COVID, it turns out. So, or not even COVID, like I think Pete Horsley is sick and Dave Hawkins is sick, and the Evanses are struggling with poor old Zoe, who's had a number of seizures last night. So there's lots in our midst who are either having a fabulous time or a really terrible time. But thank you for coming to our Christmas Eve service. Baptists don't normally have Christmas Eve services unless it lands on a Sunday. We have to get one happening. And it also, of course, is the fourth Sunday of Advent, which Christine introduced us to earlier. So let me just put you in the frame for how this series of sermons has gone, because you may be new, or you may not have attended all four of them, or you may just not have been paying attention. And so I think it's ingenious. Christine designed this this series that... I can't see it on here. That follows the lyrics of... not the lyrics, the titles of Jesus in this hymn, O Come, O Come, Emmanuel. And at first when she said to me, would you do the fourth one and would you talk about the Desire of Nations, which is one of the titles of Jesus in this hymn, O Come, Emmanuel, which we've sung every Sunday except today for some reason, I thought, sure, okay, I'll do it. But what's the big deal about O Come, Emmanuel? Like, it's a nice, like, Advent hymn and all, but why are we kind of focused particularly on that? And so I did some research so that you don't have to. I'm not into hymns or hymnology, but here's what I discovered. Christians have been singing or chanting a version of this song since the 8th century. Like, monks used to chant, not with the tune that we have, but they used to chant something that approximates the lyrics of the song that we sing since the 8th or 9th century. In the 12th century, it became a congregational hymn for singing in churches in Latin with lyrics that approximate the song that we sing. And then, as you can see on the screen, in 1851, a Church of England minister called John Neill translated it and kind of expanded the lyrics into the song that we now have. So we've been singing a song every Sunday in Advent, except this Sunday, that Christians have been in one form or another singing for 1,500 years. That's pretty remarkable when you think about it. And in fact, a couple of weeks ago, when Adam Lear led us in the singing of this hymn, he included two verses that a friend of mine has written this year to reflect on the cry for, the yearning for peace in Gaza, and reflecting on the current situation there. So from the 8th century to 2023, these lyrics have been kind of emerging and developing. So it's an ancient, ancient hymn that Christians have sung over and over. And so Christine chose four of the titles that the song gives to Jesus to just kind of frame our thinking. We jump out of the song into the scriptures, but these are the three that Christine looked at. So Jesus as the bright and morning star, Jesus as the wisdom from on high, and last week, remember, we got little keys, Jesus as the key of David. And so this week, we're going to look at Jesus as the desire of nations, which is not a phrase that we might kind of use very frequently, but it comes from this particular verse, which I hoped we had sung already today, but I will sing it for you. No, I will simply read it for you now. O come, desire of nations, bind all peoples in one heart and mind. Bid envy, strife, and quarrel cease. Fill the whole world with heaven's peace. And so Neil writes these words based on the assumption that the whole world is yearning for peace, and that in fact, Christ is the only opportunity for true peace to come to this world. So whether all the nations acknowledge this or not, their yearning for peace is unconsciously a yearning for Christ. Jesus therefore becomes the desire of nations. If you kind of get the gist of this, which got me thinking about, well, what was he thinking about peace when he wrote this in the 1850s? He's English, so I thought to myself, you know, what was England like in the 1850s that he should be desire or recognizing that the nations would yearn for peace? And what I discovered, you probably discovered this way back in modern history class, is that England was at war perpetually through the 19th century, like literally one war after another. This is a painting of Wellington leading his forces against Napoleon in the Napoleonic Wars. But that was just the beginning of the 19th century. Like, this is the list of wars, major wars, that England was involved in during the first half, just up until he wrote these words in this song. They were fighting the Nepalese, the Burmese, the Maori. They were fighting the Chinese and the Taiping Rebellion. I mean, you can read the list there. And folks, that is just the major wars. If I included all the skirmishes and battles and revolts and what have you, it would be like twice as long again. So you can imagine growing up in England at that time, it was perpetually and continuously warring. And not just England, because, again, you remember this surely from modern history class, 1848. Was called the Year of Revolution in Europe, remember this? From France in the west all the way to the Ottoman Empire and the Russian Empire in the east, Europe just burst into flames with one revolutionary war after another cascading throughout Europe. So you can imagine, can't you? If you are in England in 1850 and you are continually seeing troops being sent out to various theatres of war around the world and you're hearing about the whole of Europe inflamed by revolution and war, you can imagine why you would write these words, wouldn't you? You'd imagine why you would say, "Oh, desire of nations, come. Come and bid all hearts to be one in peace." This is the desire of nations. In many respects, this is not just me exegeting a hymn from the 1850s. This kind of fits perfectly with all that we've been seeing throughout our studies in the book of Isaiah up until this time. Christine always apologizes when she mentions Isaiah, having gone through that extremely long series, but I'm not apologizing at all, because I've mentioned to you this whenever I've had an opportunity to preach here. You cannot get Matthew, Mark, or Luke in particular unless you understand Isaiah. Isaiah just backgrounds the Synoptic Gospels so totally. So much of what's mentioned in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, from the words of Jesus, the actions of Jesus, or reflections on what Jesus said or did, actually have hints of or resonance to or even direct quotes from the book of Isaiah. So even though it was a really long series that we went through, if you don't understand that backgrounding, you kind of don't get the whole story. That in fact what Isaiah is yearning for is that the Messiah should come. And that the Messiah is not just the desire of Israel, it's not that just we Israelites are yearning for a great king who is like the son of David to come, but rather all the way through Isaiah there are hints of the fact that all nations yearn for this. That nations want to be at peace. That nations want the very thing that this Messiah will come and bring to us in Israel, and that it will trickle out beyond Israel, out to every nation in the world. Which is why, as Sharon read to us before, it's why we often read a prophecy from Isaiah like this one, where Isaiah speaks of the hope for or the yearning of this Messiah to come, and he says, "For a child will be born to us, a son will be given to us, and the government, the way in which society is organized, will be upon his shoulders, and his name will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Eternal Father, Prince of Peace," as all nations desire peace. And we know that because every person in the Miss World competition desires world peace. The world desires peace. And what they're actually desiring is that the Prince of Peace would come and would usher in a whole new era, a new way of being human, and a whole new kind of society. And this is shown in various parts in Isaiah. So if we just kind of jump back to Isaiah chapter 2. Into Isaiah chapter 2. Listen to this magnificent, I know we looked at Isaiah chapter 2 a long time ago, but look at this magnificent vision of what Isaiah imagines the coming of the Messiah will be like. He says, "In the last days, the mountain of the Lord's temple will be established as the highest of the mountains. It will be exalted above the hills, and all nations will stream to it. Many peoples will come and say, 'Come, Let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the temple of God of Jacob. He will teach us his ways that we may walk in his paths. The law will go out from Zion, the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. He will judge between the nations and settle disputes for many peoples. They will beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation will not take up sword against nation, nor will they train for war anymore. Come, descendants of Jacob, let us walk in the light of the Lord. Isn't this a magnificent, almost cosmic idea of what the future will be like? That whether it's an actual mountain or not, there will be this high place, a holy place, in which the God of Jacob, Yahweh, will be at one with his people. Not just his people, the Jews, not just his people, Israel, but all nations will come to this place. And in worship of Yahweh, they will be transformed as people. He will teach them his ways, and they will know how to walk in his paths. They will become people of peace and people of justice and love and mercy. And that this will ripple out from beyond this experience. So not just these people will be transformed, but all the nations of the world will. There'll be no reason for swords or for spears. There'll be no reason to train armies any longer. The world will be at peace. This is the desire of nations. This is what every country around the world yearns for. It's only possible, said Isaiah, through this son of David, this one that we yearn for, this king that we anticipate who will come and who will set all things right. And then another version of this, which I absolutely love, but I haven't got time to read, is Isaiah 60. Isaiah 60 begins, it's just a similar kind of prophecy, but in Isaiah 60 it says, verse 1 says, "Arise, shine, for your light has come and the glory of the Lord rises on you." And then verse 3 says, "Nations will come to your light and kings to the brightness of your dawn." It's reiterating the kind of prophecy from Isaiah 2. It's not just that we, Israelites, will be transformed, but all nations yearn for this same transformation, and that they will all come in order to experience this. And as I said, I haven't got time to read the whole thing, but then there's a list of all the peoples from these various nations who will come almost as it were in caravans to Israel, bringing what they can for the building of this new society. So the Midianites will come and they will drive herds of camels, beasts of burden, to Israel in order to contribute to the making of this new world. And from Sheba, which some think is Ethiopia, others think it's at the end of the Arabian Peninsula, but irrespective, they will bring gold and incense to Israel. And you have the people from Kedar, which are nomadic people in the middle of the Arabian desert. They will drive sheep, flocks of sheep, and from Tarshish by boat will come gold and silver. So you have this idea of all these people converging on Israel, bringing what they can to the building of this new society. It's not Zionism in that sense. Rather, it's the transformation of a whole new world order of peace and love and cooperation. It's this magnificent vision. This is what Isaiah anticipates will happen. When the Messiah comes, when the Anointed One is here, a whole new way of being human, a whole new society is going to be unleashed on the world. That's all just review. Remember that from what we've been doing all year? So that when you get to the Christmas story, and I'm going to pick on Matthew today, when you get to Matthew's story, you've got to understand he probably knew Isaiah backwards. And so when he comes to tell the story of the birth of Jesus, have a look, I know it's Christmas, but have a look at what they say in the movies are these Easter eggs that are in the story, which are all these little clues, all these like little presents throughout the story, which if you know Isaiah, and if you have this yearning in your heart of Isaiah chapter 60 or Isaiah chapter 2, if you have that in your bones, when you read the story of Jesus' birth, it's like bing, 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 bing. All these resonances are going off and reminding you of all the yearnings that we've had for this whole new world. It's not just Jesus like God. Is Jesus God's Christmas present for you because he loves you, you gorgeous little snowflake? Rather, it's like, ay, 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 this cosmic dream, this global international dream of a whole new world, a world set right. It's starting now. It's starting here. And so, as you know, in Matthew's gospel, it begins with a genealogy. We just jump over that part, don't we? Like, we're not the least bit interested in that. 17 verses, 48 names, all the forebears of Jesus, all the fathers and sons and fathers and sons and so on and so forth, all the way back throughout time. That's classic kind of introduction of great men in antiquity. You would identify them by their lineage. This particular painting from the Renaissance is a painting of that's Jesse lying on the ground with his red cloak on, and from his side, the root of Jesse is growing into a tree, and there are all the descendants of Jesse, including King David, all the way up to the baby Jesus at the top of the picture. Now, when you look at it, most people think, wait a second, they all look like European men. Well, of course they do, because he didn't have an encyclopedia or Google Images, or he'd never been to the Middle East, so he paints them like European men. More concerning is the fact that they're all men. And here's the remarkable thing. Here's Matthew going all Isaiah on you, because when he comes to write the genealogy, he just doesn't pick men, and he doesn't even just pick the great men. What he includes in this genealogy, which is really subversive and surprising and super Isaianic, is that he includes four women in the list, five if you include Mary. And I would love to preach a whole series just on these four women, because they're badass. But the thing I do want to make, the point I do want to make about the four of them is this. At least three of them, and possibly all four of them, are Gentiles. You have Tamar, who's the daughter-in-law of Judah. You have Rahab, who is the prostitute from Jericho, who conspires with the spies from Israel. You have Ruth, who is a Moabite. And then Bathsheba, that's the one that the jury is out on. She's married to a Hittite, and there's questions about whether he is a Gentile. Interestingly, in Matthew's telling of this story, she's not named. She's called the wife of Uriah, not the wife of David. And so it's almost like maybe Matthew is wanting to particularly emphasize the fact, whether she's Gentile or not, she's married to a Hittite. So in this story, from the very beginning, if you background it with everything I said from Isaiah, even the genealogy is telling us that through the veins of this little boy, through the veins of this infant, flows the blood of Gentile women. And that's the first clue, that everything that Isaiah anticipated, all the nations coming together to be transformed in relationship to God through the Messiah, his blood is international in a sense. But then, of course, as was just read to us before, you then have this intriguing story after the birth narrative. You have this intriguing story of these men from the East coming to worship him. Who are these people? Why have they come? It's intriguing. There's much we could make of this, but I don't have time to do this other than to say, what are the gifts that these men bring to the infant Christ? Gold and incense. Remember what I read to you about what the people from Sheba and the people from Tarshish will bring to the building of this new society? Gold and incense. That in a sense, this particular story kind of foregrounds the gigantic background that Isaiah has for us. Hey, we've been dreaming of a time when all the nations will bring gifts to us in order that we might bring and build this global, international world of peace. And here it's beginning with Gentiles coming to us and presenting gifts to the Messiah. And then if that's not enough for you, they then have Joseph being warned in a dream to flee to Egypt. That's a fantastic painting, don't you think? This magnificent kind of storyline doesn't just include the Gentile blood flowing through Jesus' veins. It doesn't just include Gentiles coming from afar to present gifts to the Messiah. It also includes the Messiah being raised in a foreign land, at least for part of his childhood. Not just a foreign land, but of all foreign lands, one of the mortal enemies of Israel in the land of Egypt. Like, just in the first two chapters of this story, if you were really familiar with Isaiah from the first centuries of the Christian era, if you were soaked in the prophecies of Isaiah and you just read this far, two chapters into Matthew, you'd be like, ay, ay, ay. This is the beginnings. This is the start of everything that we've dreamed of and hoped for. A global world of peace, nations coming together, all becoming one. And then just in case you didn't quite get it, of course, then there is a really vexing story and a deeply distressing story that follows immediately after that. Just in case you thought he's come to bring peace and all will be well and we'll have Magi from the east and we'll have Egypt and the whole world will come together, you then have a dramatic reminder of the fact that even in this world, there are still despots and rulers and tyrants. There is still fear and violence and slaughter of the innocents. Because immediately after this story and Joseph's escape with his family to Egypt, you have Herod commanding the slaughter of the infants in Bethlehem. It's a distressing and disturbing and, frankly, it is a troubling story to have in our Gospels. But I think in a way, one of the things it does is it reminds us of the fact that the Messiah doesn't come to magically make peace among all peoples, but rather this peace is sown into the world like seed and that will slowly but surely yield its fruit while still growing in the poisoned earth of despots and rulers and wars and violence and the slaughter of innocent children. Are you all with me so far? See, our story is a magnificent story, a hope of peace, the desire of the nations. This is what we celebrate when we come together in worship. This is why we would say that if we follow the Prince of Peace, if we, like Isaiah way before us, like John Neal who translated this poem in the 1850s, if we desire and yearn for peace as followers of the Prince of Peace, then our task is to live like that. That's why I think that you can have somebody like Paul writing to the Colossians and say this to them. It's like, here's the way I want you to live. Like you say you follow the Prince of Peace, well then let the peace of Christ rule in your hearts. Since as members of one body you are called to peace and be thankful. The followers of the Prince of Peace are to be the peacemakers of this world, right? We agree with Isaiah, this is the world that we've desired. We agree with Matthew that this is the Messiah who was promised. We agree with John Neal that this is the desire of nations for global peace. We agree with all of this. He is our King. He is the Prince of Peace. Therefore, let the peace of Christ rule in your hearts. I preached on Colossians chapter 3 in this church, I think it was last year. I don't expect you to remember it all. But I talked about how at the beginning of Colossians chapter 3, Paul begins by saying, set your mind on Christ. Remember this? Set your hearts on Christ. And he then goes on to use all this language of clothing, like, put on Christ or clothe yourself in Christ. Immerse yourself in Christ, the Prince of Peace. And when I preached on this, I used the illustration of, well, we don't get into cloaks and things like that, but I used the illustration of VR goggles. You know, when you've ever used VR goggles, it's kind of like you put them on and now the whole world is completely different if you've ever experienced VR goggles. So I said, it's a little bit like what Paul is saying is, put on Christ. See the world by like Christ, be shaped by Christ. And then after he says that, he then says, that means you won't live like this. And he lists all these things, anger and war and malice and strife and lies and deceit. So you won't live like that because that's the old way. But when you put on Christ, you'll live like this. And this is what it looks like. This is precedes his call for us to be people of peace. He says, here, when you put on Christ, here, there is no Gentile or Jew, circumcised or uncircumcised, barbarian, Scythian, slave or free. For Christ is all and is in all. Do you hear what he's saying? He's the Prince of Peace. So he doesn't concern himself with the demarcations that we draw out for ourselves. He hasn't got any concern about rich or poor or old or young or male or female. He's not concerned about these kind of lines that separate us, foreigner and citizen and this and that and the other. No, here, all of that's immaterial for him. He doesn't even see those things. All are one and he is in all. And then he goes on to say, therefore, if you believe that that's true, as God's chosen people, holy and dearly loved, clothe yourselves. There's that putting on language again. Clothe yourselves with these things, compassion, kindness, humility, gentleness and patience. These are all expressions of peace. And more than that, he says, bear with each other, Forgive one another if any of you has a grievance against someone. Forgive as the Lord forgave you. And over all these virtues, put on love which binds them all together in perfect unity. Everything Isaiah dreamed of, everything that Jesus sows into the world at his birth, his life, his death, his resurrection, and his ascension, all of that now is ours. By the ministry of the Holy Spirit in our lives, put on Christ and become people of peace. Resolve yourself to live like this. Sounds good? You're with me? Yeah, except for the most part, lots of Christians have been really shit at it, right? Like, would our nation think, who should we go to teach us how to be peace lovers? Who should we go to know what it's like to be peacemakers in this world? How many times have your non-Christian friends to you, have non-Christians said to you, yeah, well, I think religion actually causes lots of wars and lots of strife and violence in this world. There are lots of people who don't see Christians as examples of peace in this world. In fact, as long ago as the 1930s, Mahatma Gandhi said this about the British in India. He said, it is a first-class human tragedy that the people who claim to believe in the message of Jesus, whom they describe as the Prince of Peace, show little of that belief in actual practice. Shame on us. Shame on us that those of us who claim we have been born of the Spirit, filled with the Spirit of Jesus, caught up into this magnificent global vision of a united humankind, of oneness, of peace, the desire of nations made possible only by the power and the work of Jesus in our lives. Shame on us that so many of us have been seen as being the opposite of that. Argumentative, strife-ridden, violent sometimes in the pursuit of our needs or concerns. I've seen it even more recently in the current crisis in Gaza, where if any Christian would dare to speak out about the need for a ceasefire, for a negotiated peace, for peace and safety, for the provision of aid to those who suffer in Gaza, any Christian who speaks what I believe would be the words of Jesus in this midst, a call for peace, a call for love, a call for justice. Anyone who dares to do that gets called pro-Palestinian, pro-terrorist, anti-Semitic, anti-Israel, anti-biblical. Well, I say no. I say if we yearn for this oneness of humankind that Isaiah taught us about, which Jesus promises us, with the Christmas story reveals to us, then surely it's our task to recognize that as followers of Jesus, we are to be filled with the Spirit of peace. My friend Shane Claiborne tweeted this recently about this because he's copped it for daring to call for peace. He says this, to be pro-life means being for every life, and it means consistently standing up against everything that crushes human beings made in the image of God. It's not enough to be pro-Israel or pro-Palestine. We've got to be pro-peace, because every Palestinian life is just as sacred as every Israeli life. Do you agree? Even though, friends, you cop a hiding for daring to say such things as this, and you should read the comment, no, you shouldn't read the comments, Christians have made in response to Shane's tweet. Nonetheless, we ought to be seen as those who are like the seeds of the kingdom in this world, being sown by Christ in a whole new world. Now, I don't want to leave it there. Can I tell you about one of my favorite stories of a church of peace that I visited, I think it was just before COVID, 4 years ago. This church meets right near on the border between the United States and Mexico. Half of the congregation is in San Diego, and the other half is in Tijuana. And they meet under the leadership of Pastor Guillermo Navarrete. I happened to meet him. We spoke at a conference together and he took me to his church. That's him leading the church in worship. As you can see, there's bread and juice there. They're going to have communion together. And that gigantic, big monstrosity behind him is the border wall between Mexico and the United States. And the thing I really love about this church, it's called the Border Church. In Tijuana, it's called La Iglesia Fronteriza, same word, same kind. They push them up against the wall as though it's one table divided by this gigantic wall. And then they conduct a service in English and Spanish so that each of them can kind of hear the service being led. And they believe that they are one church, not two churches meeting at the same place, one congregation made up of Mexicans on one side and of Americans and Mexicans, both documented and undocumented, on the American side. Here are some more pictures of the border church. One of the beautiful things that they used to do when the wall was just bars, it was just like a cage, was they used to close their service with the passing of the peace. Do you know how you pass the peace, where you put your hands out? Do you know? Do you all know this? Yep. Well, no? Okay, so Carmen, can you just...
So I would say, this will be upon you, is that also for you, and then you pass it on to the next person.
They used to squeeze their hands between the bars, and they used to pass the peace together. But a certain recent president actually bolstered that wall by putting grills through the bars. And so now, can you see the woman on the bottom left-hand side of the screen? She's poking her pinky through the little tiny hole. This is how they pass the peace. They just touch pinkies through the little tiny grill holes. Some of you are laughing at that, but I actually found it incredibly poignant and really sad, actually, that even if this tiny little bit of touching is all we can have, this, when done by people filled with the Spirit of Jesus, committed to global peace, trusting, believing that the Prince of Peace is bringing about a new kind of world and a new kind of society, I find it the most foolhardy, almost ridiculous thing to believe in, that the world can build these gigantic steel structures, but the people of faith, filled with the Spirit of Jesus, still have faith enough to dare to believe that peace will reign. This is Christmas, my friends, the coming of the Prince of Peace. Let us resolve this year coming once again to be devoted warriors of social justice and peacemaking and love and kindness in a world that builds wars, that demarcates people from each other, who fosters hatred and suspicion. Let us be a different kind of people, because we are the followers of the Prince of Peace. You are with me? Let me pray. Help us, Lord Jesus. Help us as we face a new year to be those people that Paul called the Colossians to be. People of kindness and compassion, humility and gentleness. People who forgive and love. People who commit themselves to the making of peace in a world that builds walls. Of seeing no distinction between slave or free, rich or poor, male or female, but who acknowledges you have made us all one and you are in all. Help us glorify you by being your hands and your feet. And might it be that all nations come to see that you are the desire that they've had all along.